This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 184, The Tribble Whisperer. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Nichelle Nichols' upcoming NASA flight, Shatner's mosaic tribute to Leonard Nimoy, and Creation's plans for Star Trek's 50th anniversary in Vegas. And we also remember TOS guest star Yvonne Craig. Then in the feature, we're joined by Andy Vanderkolk and Zachary Frueling to discuss the classic episode, The Trouble with Tribbles. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. It's great to have you back here with me on The Ready Room. It's been a while since I've recorded one of these. My life has been absolutely insane, as I know yours is as well, especially coming up. But I'm glad you set aside some time to come and talk, not DS9, but TOS this time.
Well, Chris, I think you can tell that my life is a little bit insane because it's all in boxes behind me here at the palatial Trek FM studios of the northwest corner of the United States. And packing things up and moving a little bit south from where I am now, and it's actually happening next weekend from when we're recording this. So spent quite a bit of the morning packing up the kitchen, and life is crazy. So, but it's great to be here to talk some Star Trek.
Well, I have to ask you, as you're packing and you've got those boxes there, you didn't find any tribbles in there, did you?
You know, Chris, you asked that question, and my wife actually asked me today. She woke up this morning, and I was watching the Trouble with Tribbles episode, and she's like, do you have a tribble? And I was like, well, I did at one point. And so, actually, there may be a tribble in one of these boxes that I'm not quite aware of. It's just a stuffed tribble.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
because I was really confused there, Matthew, mm-hmm. because it's not possible to just have one tribble, you know.
Right. Mine's just a stuffed tribble. It's one of those that had too much Quattro Triticale, and it was actually poisoned. Mine's been preserved so that I don't have to worry about, you know, overpopulation of my house with tribbles.
That's good. That's good. And so your Klingon guests will be very happy about that as well.
Oh my gosh, I tried to have Worf over. He saw that thing. He almost threw it out the window. I was like, it's not real. It's not real. It's like, we do not speak of it to outsiders.
Exactly. Well, we're going to talk more about Tribbles later in the feature when Zachary and Andy join us to talk about The Trouble with Tribbles. Before that, we have some news to talk about, and it's a lot of TOS-oriented news this week. And the first one is a sad note, something that's been happening way too often for us this year as Star Trek fans. And we've lost another member of the Star Trek family, someone from the original series, Yvonne Craig, who played Marta, the Orion slave girl in Whom Gods Destroy, passed away at the age of 78 after a 2-year fight with breast cancer. And once again, you know, not a main cast member, but yet one of the most memorable characters from the original series. The actress portraying her has been lost.
Chris, it is sad when this happens to us, and it is kind of unfortunate that the time that we are in, it's going to become more and more frequent for the stars of the original series.
Inevitable, yeah.
But it is funny because, you know, for me, every time I kind of hear her name, I can't stop thinking of the Batman theme song from, you know, the 66 Batman, because she was Barbara Gordon, a.k.a. Batgirl. And, yeah, I mean, these people are just amazing. What I love especially about, I think of as 60s television, like whether it was something like Batman or something like Star Trek. You know, people that played smaller characters or smaller roles, especially her with playing, you know, just the Orion slave girl, Marta, in Whom Gods Destroy, it's very interesting because, you know, this minor role, and yet in Star Trek, that's a big deal. You know, you can, you could basically go to a convention and people would still want your autograph. That's how much Star Trek fans love Star Trek people. And the people that have been in there, we embrace them, you know. And I think that's a wonderful thing about Star Trek. And it really just goes to show how big a heart that Star Trek fans have for the people who are involved in Star Trek, whether it's in front of the camera or behind the camera.
Absolutely. Yeah. So she passed away at her home in Pacific Palisades, California. And go watch some of her work, you know, to celebrate her. We did consider doing Whom Gods Destroy for this episode, but I actually want to save that because it is the basis of Axanar. And so when I discuss that, I actually want to have Alec on with us to talk about that. And we couldn't do that for this episode. But go watch Whom Gods Destroy. Go watch some Batman. I remember when I was a kid watching Batman.
Batman!
Yeah, it's good stuff. And also, she was on Fantasy Island, $6 Million Man, Kojak. She did movies with Elvis Presley. It Happened at the World's Fair, Kissing Cousins. So lots of stuff there. Or, you know, just go to her page on IMDb and you'll get the whole list and pick out some stuff and celebrate her career. And it's really sad that we've lost her.
Man, Chris, you said $6 Million Man, and all I could think was the shun-na-na-na-na-na-na. I mean, like, those 60s TV shows had the best theme songs. It's just fantastic. Yeah. So, but yeah, we'll definitely remember her, and what a fantastic way to celebrate her life by watching her work and being thankful that she was a part of that, and she'll always live on now.
Definitely. Well, the next thing that we want to talk about is also related to a woman from the original series, the beloved Nichelle Nichols, who is thankfully still with us at the age of 82. She has, and everyone knows this, for years and years and years, she has been a spokesperson for NASA, and she's played a very important role in getting more women into the sciences and really helping champion science education for women and space exploration. And although this new story is not about her actually going into space per se, she's going to get very close, traveling up to 50,000 feet into the stratosphere aboard the SOFIA, which is the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy Telescope. They take it up on a 747, special modified 747, and she's going to be flying with them in September when they go up.
That's just really cool, Chris. You know, if anybody, I think, really deserves to be up there, it is any of the cast of TOS. And I'm loving the fact that Nichelle Nichols, you know, at her age, is going to be doing something of this nature. It's just fantastic. I can just imagine how excited that she is to be getting that close to space. And gosh, I'm a little bit jealous. And just think of how fun that would be to, you know, be doing this.
Yeah, yeah, it's a nice thing. It's actually, for those who don't know about SOFIA, it's a joint project between the U.S. and Germany, and they've been flying since 2010, and they fly in different parts of the world. And yeah, they go up there, and again, it is an infrared telescope, but the data that they can collect from that is very valuable scientifically, so I think it's a great tribute to her and the original Star Trek as explorers. And it does make me a little sad, though, Matthew, actually, when I think about the fact that we don't have the shuttle program anymore, because if the shuttle program had progressed the way that it should have progressed, and if they were still flying now, I think there would be an opportunity for Nichelle to actually go up on a shuttle mission at this point. I mean, I don't know about age 82, but maybe. I mean,
yeah, it's possible. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was just reading an article the other day about how we shut down the shuttle program, and now we're paying other people to take stuff up to the International Space Station and our astronauts up to the space station.
Yeah, right.
It's like, why are we shutting down this program if we don't have anything to replace it with, and we're not really actively, seemingly pursuing what we're going to replace it with? So it is very frustrating.
Well, I think the idea was that there would be something to replace it, but then that didn't pan out. So
yeah. Well, oh well.
It's unfortunate, but great for Nichelle that she's going to be going up on this flight. And I think it's just great that NASA continues to honor the original Star Trek actors in this way and recognize the important role that Star Trek played, and obviously the important role that Nichelle Nichols has played over the years for the space agency and for education, and giving her an opportunity to go do this. So one more thing related to the original series to talk about, Matthew. William Shatner, he put out this sort of mysterious tweet a while back asking fans to send him photos. And at that point in time, he didn't really say what he was going to do with them, although you did need to send them to a specific email address, which was nimoytribute@gmail.com. So you had some idea what he was going to do, but not entirely. Turns out he took all of these photos and he turned them into a giant mosaic of Spock.
It is really cool what he did with these pictures. And, you know, it's just a tribute, I think, to the relationship between Shatner and Nimoy, and Shatner really honoring his friend. I love that the picture of Spock that was from the classic Vulcan episode Among Time, and mm-hmm. Spock giving, of course, the Vulcan salute. And it's you know, it makes me sad kind of a little bit all over again that Leonard Nimoy is gone. And this is a fantastic way to I think give fans their way of feeling a part of who he was, and that in a lot of ways too, you know, if it wasn't for fans, you know, Leonard Nimoy wouldn't be as popular as he was in the first place. And so that there's this great symbiotic relationship between the two, and a great love between the two. And that's really what this is to me, is just a great labor of love from Shatner, from the fans, and because we remember the great person that Leonard Nimoy was. I got to see him in Dallas on his last run of conventions, which randomly happened. I wasn't supposed to go to that convention, but I ended up getting press passes to it through a friend. Got to see him, and he was just a fantastic human being. And, you know, it's really nice, I think, to see that as much of a rivalry that these two guys had early on, you know, on Star Trek, yeah, both wanting to, you know, play the roles the best they could and have the best lines, that they really truly became great friends and stayed great friends for their entire lives. And I know that I'm sure William misses his friends, and we all miss Spock and of course Leonard Nimoy. And this is a great way for us to just be able to honor him.
Yeah, definitely. And the mosaic looks fantastic. I don't know exactly how many images were used to create the mosaic, and I've tried to look that up and I haven't found the number yet, but it's thousands probably, at least. And the image looks great. I've taken part in a couple of these before, actually, where I've submitted things for Mosaic, or even Trek FM, we've submitted our logo before for Mosaic to do an Enterprise or things like that. So it is a great way to be part of something, and especially with it being Leonard Nimoy, like you said, it's a great way for fans to feel a connection there as part of that tribute, but that their actual image is there in the tribute. This is going to benefit a charity called Gishwes, I believe is the way that you pronounce it. It stands for the greatest international scavenger hunt the world has ever seen. Gishwes. So, but this also funds, this organization, this charity funds the nonprofit Random Acts. So this is a way to honor Leonard Nimoy and also help others at the same time. So great idea by William Shatner here. And according to StarTrek.com, he's also forwarding the mosaic to the Guinness Book of World Records, which I guess would mean mosaic made with the most images, perhaps. I don't know for sure. I've seen a lot of mosaics, and I don't know if this would actually be the record for most images used or not.
That is a good question, Chris. But regardless, it is a really nice looking image, and this is a great way to remember Leonard Nimoy, and just the perfect thing for fans to have on their walls to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a really cool thing that William Shatner has created here, and hopefully I'll get to see it up close at some point. All right, last news item that we have here today is just to let everyone know something that you already know, I'm sure, if you follow Star Trek news at all, the fact that Creation Entertainment and CBS Consumer Products have already announced the official Star Trek 50th Anniversary Convention, which will take place next August 3rd through 7th at the Rio in Las Vegas. And if you want to go and you want to stay at the Rio, you better get on it quickly because, Matthew, you've already been investigating the room availability and it's not looking good, is it?
It's not. And I'm not surprised, Chris. You know, this is going to be a huge event. They're actually going to be holding this for 5 days for the first time. So this is a huge convention. I mean, this is one of the longest conventions I've ever seen. There's going to be over 100 Star Trek celebrities apparently to appear. And it is the first time that this is going to be running for 5 full days. So, you know, when they say what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, I guess even at the Rio for 5 days of, with the internet, I don't know if that's going to be able to happen for some people.
Right. Yeah, I think that ad campaign, and I actually knew the people who came up with that ad campaign because when I lived in Nevada, I was involved in the marketing stuff, associations there, but that was pre-modern internet,
yeah.
Right there. So I think pre-social media as we know it now. So I don't know that that slogan really holds up anymore.
Well, and, you know, I think that this is pretty exciting. They really want to make this, I think it sounds like the biggest Star Trek convention, the best Star Trek convention, and a place where no matter what the ticket price is, they say, that person has a chance to see the stars when they want without fear of waiting or not getting in. So it looks like they're doing all they can to make this a full-on celebration of Star Trek's 50th anniversary, which is great because it's kind of the first time so far that I've seen them make a big deal of anything about Star Trek for the 50th anniversary, sadly enough.
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't it? Except for that logo that they came up with. There just really
yeah,
hasn't
it's a fancy
been
logo.
Much out there.
Yeah. So,
it's good to see that they're at least getting a jump on this.
And we didn't mention really, I mean, but there was the great leak of news for the new movie that, you know, that they're working very hard on and will be coming out in July. So Star Trek 3, Star Trek Beyond, whatever we're calling it these
days. Star Trek Beyond!
Yes, it is coming out too. And so crossing my fingers because, you know, talking to David Mack recently on Literary Treks, and he's working on the 50th anniversary book series that they're doing with him, Greg Cox, and Dayton Ward and Kevin Dillmore. You know, I think that at least the book series seems to recognize this as a big deal. So who knows what we're going to get in the mix as we get closer, you know, to 2016. Hopefully Paramount and CBS both have some things up their sleeve to give to fans. I think, honestly, all fans, if we had a wish, it would be Deep Space Nine and Voyager on Blu-ray.
And a new TV series. Our wish
yeah, there
list
you go.
Is very long, Matthew.
Chris, that's three things. It's not that hard.
I know, but what about mine? You know, that series starring Loeffler.
Well, that's true. Loeffler's Laws. I'd still watch that, too.
I think David E. Kelly is working on that, actually.
Oh, I could see that. You know, Chris, I do have to say, I mean, they're continuing now the New Frontier series, and Loeffler plays a pretty big part in that, so you might just want to start rereading New Frontier.
Get back into that, definitely. All right, so if you're planning to go to the convention next year, head on over. Creation Entertainment's website is creationent.com/ST50, and that'll get you there. And they will be putting information up there about that. Also, if you've got a lot of extra time and you've got some money and you want to just really go all out for the 50th, I do encourage you to go over to Geek Nation Tours. My friend Larry Nemechek is going to be guiding this tour again, along with Terrace Cassidy. And they're not only doing LA over to Vegas this time, but they're also going up doing some San Francisco stuff as well. So it's a great way to, you know, visit the sites where Star Trek was filmed and hear all the inside stuff. And it leads into the convention, so you can make like a two-week extravaganza out of all that.
Unfortunately, Chris, I haven't won the lottery yet. So.
Well, I know, but for those who can, and they've already got 20 people signed up for that tour.
That's awesome.
It's really an experience, so go check that out, Geek Nation Tours, if you want to make a huge bash out of it. All right, well, we're going to go into the feature in a second. We want to remind everyone first that The Ready Room is just one of many shows that we have here on the network on Trek FM. We have shows covering every single series. We have a dedicated show for every series. We also talk about Star Trek creatives beyond Star Trek, things they've worked on. We talk about science and music and books and comics and everything that you can imagine. So go to iTunes.com/TrekFM. If you're an Apple user, that'll take you right into our artist section. We are a featured provider with Apple in iTunes, so we have a whole section there for you. And you can also go to our website, trek.fm. If you're an Android user on our website, you can get the RSS link and drop that into another app. Or just look in an app like Pocket Casts or other apps like that that are available on Android and also on iOS. And just search for Trek FM, search for the show name that you want to listen to as well. It'll all come right up. Please subscribe. That helps us out a lot. And we have so much waiting for you here on the network. We also want to thank our associate producers here on the show, Renee Roberts, a dear friend who has been supporting the network for years and years. Also, Zachary Frueling, who you'll meet in just a moment here in the feature. They help us keep the network going. You can find Zachary on Twitter at Zachary Frueling, and he's going to spell that for you later on, I know. And also, Renee is on Twitter, Mares_1701 is her username. And if you'd like to support the show and the network and help us keep Star Trek Talk coming, please go over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We are a listener-supported network, so we need your help to keep our shows coming. You can get all the information there, and we really thank you for your support. And anything you can contribute makes a huge difference for us. So thanks so much to all of our patrons out there. All right, Matthew, let's go ahead and jump into the feature. They're the cutest, most prolific aliens in the Star Trek universe, and also the furriest. They are, of course, Tribbles, and at 6 credits a head, or a body, they also make for good business. At least that's what Cyrano Jones thought, until the critters got a hankering for some wheat. The Trouble with Tribbles remains one of the most beloved Star Trek episodes, nearly 50 years after it aired, and today we're going to discuss why that is. To help us do that, we're joined by someone you know as a guest on many shows around the network, as well as a co-host of Women at Warp. It's Andy Vanderkolk. Andy, welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I love this episode so much. I'm so excited to talk about it.
Yeah, you told me that I save all the great TOS episodes for you, apparently.
Yeah, well, I mean, last time we got to do City on the Edge of Forever, and then now I get to do Trouble with Tribbles, so like my two favorite ends of the Star Trek spectrum, I guess. So I'm excited. Thanks for doing that for me, Chris.
Yeah, well, you know, that's why we chose it. So keeping you in mind. All right. So also joining us for his second visit to the Ready Room is one of our associate producers here on this show, Zachary Frueling. Welcome, Zachary.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be back on the Ready Room. I've had a big bowl of Quadro Triticale for breakfast, followed by a chicken sandwich and coffee for lunch with no Tribbles in sight. So I'm ready to talk about the Trouble with Tribbles.
Excellent. I'm glad that your breakfast was not poisoned.
No, it was blue, though.
It was blue. Okay. All right, guys. So we're going to talk about this episode, and it's such a famous one that I really don't feel like we need a synopsis, but just in case, the Enterprise receives a call from Deep Space Station K-7. They go there. They find out that there's some wheat that needs to be protected because there's this planet, Sherman's planet. And they actually reference the Organian peace treaty from Erend of Mercy, and that sets up the conflict or the trouble here between the Federation and the Klingons and who's going to have access to this planet and who's going to settle the planet. And then the Klingons show up, but also this dealer, Cyrano Jones, shows up with these little furry guys, Tribbles, who we feel like have always been part of Star Trek, but this was the first time we saw them. And all hell breaks loose on the station. The Klingons, they're going to poison the wheat. The Tribbles want to eat the wheat. Kirk's not happy about any of it. And then at the end, spoiler alert, in case you haven't seen it after 50 years, we find out that one of the people is actually a Klingon in disguise.
Oh, great, Chris. Now it's ruined for me.
I know. I'm sorry. And of course, he does come back later at another point in Star Trek. So that's the synopsis. What about our initial thoughts here? Andy, I'm going to start with you because you said this is just one of your absolute favorite episodes. So what are your initial thoughts on The Trouble with Tribbles?
I think my favorite thing about it is they managed to really balance, you know, the humor, but also a fair amount of pretty good world building. And I really like how it says a lot about bureaucracy and then also kind of like a lot of cool diplomatic scenes. So I think it's a cool balance of those different story elements. And I think it's harder than people think it is to make an enjoyable episode that's just not fluff. And I was really impressed with this one. And I mean, you laugh all the way through it, but it actually does have some stuff to stay. So that's always my favorite balance of things when we get a perfect episode that makes you laugh and think. I think that's why this is one of my favorites from the original series.
I saw what you did there, by the way. It's not all fluff. It's just mostly fluff, right?
Not completely, but still fluffy.
A Tribble fabric softener. Still fluffy. I mean, the tagline.
Isn't that a thing? Like, instead of snuggle, it's Tribble?
Yeah, I think so. I can see that. Yeah, instead of a bear on there, they've got a Tribble.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I would so like a Tribble.
You know, I had one and I couldn't find it.
But see, the thing that I like most is not the fuzzy, it's the cooing sound they make. It just makes me go,
Are we sure that's just not like pigeon sound that they've... That's what it sounds like. Okay, it sounds something like a bird. And I was like, huh.
Yeah, they used dove sounds and then just like changed the pitch a little bit. But yeah, I like it. I like it because it's a mix of purring and cooing, and it makes a cool sound that is almost familiar but a little bit different. And I mean, anyone who has cats know that, you know, that purring is really, really soothing. So all of those scenes where they're like cuddling them and just kind of like zoning out to the trilling sound, I love it. And it rings home for me because that's what I do when one of my cats purrs on me.
Now I'm picturing them getting ready to shoot the scenes and they bring in all these doves. They stick them in this little furry pouch and zip it up and put it around.
Oh, God.
All right. So, Zachary, what are your initial thoughts here?
Yeah, I had a really hard time thinking of my initial thoughts. Like Andy, this is one of my all-time favorite episodes. I've been watching it since I was a little kid back in the early 80s. I just have these fond memories of watching The Trouble with Tribbles and other TOS episodes on this tiny little 13-inch TV, color TV with knobs and whatnot. I think it's one of these episodes. It's probably the most well-known episode of any TOS episode, probably of any episode in Star Trek. I think maybe with the exception of The City on the Edge of Forever. You know, I was talking to a neighbor across the street, and I mentioned I was going to be recording the show tonight, and he doesn't know much about Star Trek, but he knew The Trouble with Tribbles. It's the one thing he'd heard of. Yeah. My mom's the same way. My wife was the same way. So it's this amazing episode. I was worried that anything I would say just wouldn't do justice to the humor or the charm or the lovability of this episode. I made a list of about 15 things off the top of my head that I love about this episode. I'm not going to go through the list right now. And that was just off the top of my head. I know if I sat down to make that list while watching the episode, I'd come up with 40 things, you know, little pieces of dialogue that add some charm to the episode. It's a great balance of humor, and there's some serious things going on in the episode, but it's probably 75% humor and 25% seriousness, maybe more like 90% humor and 10% seriousness. But it's one of my favorites. It's a classic. There's just no way to do it justice.
Well, you might think that the insults about the Enterprise were humorous, but Scotty disagrees with you.
He does.
That has to be one of my favorite Scotty moments of all time. Both the initial scene where he's like trying to keep his temper and then he goes one step too far and calls the Enterprise a garbage scow. And he's like, right. Nope, I'm throwing. And he just throws down. And I love how he like basically hurls that Klingon across the table and he like slides. I love that. But I mean, the cherry is then afterwards him talking to Kirk. That scene is one of my favorite, and it might be my favorite Kirk Scotty moment ever. It's just so perfect, and the chemistry between the two actors is just delightful, and the whole thing is perfect.
I love that Scotty has his own musical theme. It's kind of like a Scottish jig. You know, it really adds to the humor of everything he has to say.
It was in his contract,
well, Matthew. How about you?
You know, I was thinking about this episode and what can you add to the Trouble with Tribbles and the conversation that's been had about this episode. I was thinking it's like the Goldfinger of TOS in the sense that Goldfinger for James Bond movies is kind of like the quintessential Bond movie. It's the one that completely set the formula for what everything would be afterwards. And when we think about TOS, I think every single thing we think about TOS is in this episode. Every character is completely what you think of, the stereotypes of the characters, like Chekhov with all the Russian stuff, Scotty with his technical manuals and scotch, Kirk being quintessential Kirk. Same thing with the banter back and forth with Bones and Spock. I mean, everything here is classic TOS to the nth degree. Like this is the one episode you could point somebody and say, this is TOS, this is these characters. And I think it just shows that is a tough thing to do, to really balance all of that out. And I think if anything about this episode is it's just the most classic of the classic. And that's what makes it so special. That's what makes people love it. And that's why you can go back to it over and over and over again, as we all have, and just sit down and watch it, you know, for 40-whatever minutes. 50. And you still laugh at all the stuff.
Every time.
It really is just a well-written episode of television. And again, that's just not something that happens a lot. You know, there are 79 episodes of the original series, and you know there are very few of them that hit every single note perfectly, and I think this is one of the few that just, you know, there's nothing about this episode that's off.
So since we're talking about the humor here, let's talk a bit more about that and how this episode really does blend the seriousness and the humor together well. I found it interesting that Joseph Pevney, who directed this, made a comment one time that he made this comment in the mid 80s, maybe like 85, that they could never do an episode like this again because Star Trek had become too deadly serious, he said. But then, of course, The Voyage Home came out soon after that. And then we've had other episodes that have really captured the same spirit as well. I think of like Little Green Men on DS9 is an episode that I think works really well the way that The Trouble with Tribbles does. So what are your thoughts on this, Zachary, in terms of seriousness and humor and whether Star Trek really can recapture this type of mood?
You know, I think I generally agree with the sentiment that Star Trek has become generally more serious, although I think of episodes, you know, I'm a Voyager fan principally, so, you know, I think of things like Bride of Chaotica, and, you know, Star Trek is not afraid to delve into the utterly ridiculous sometimes, more so even than in Trouble with Tribbles, I think. I think it's hard to capture the balance, though. I think in this case, they did a really rock star job of weaving together, you know, 15 or 20 different elements, any one of which would have been funny on its own, but it's an art to weave them together and make sure everyone gets their due. I think of things in this episode that that really worked for me. We were mentioning on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
That the forces sort of conspire against Captain Kirk in this. You know, he's usually the man who's in charge. You know, he's got it under control. And in this episode, one event after another conspires against him. He thinks the this protecting this shipment of grain is totally beneath him. You know, he's trying to punish Scotty for getting into the fight, but Scotty just wants to read his technical journals. One right, thing after another, awesome. it puts this character who's supposed to be the man in charge in kind of a situation where he has to just deal with the consequences as they come, and it's out of his control to some degree. And that's inherently funny. The weaving together the one-liners and the running jokes, like the Russian inventions theme, Chekhov's running joke line.
You know what I like about that is that so often it's written in Star Trek, he makes those comments about things being invented in Russia. He's serious about it, but it's a jab at the Russians, of course, at the time in the 60s. But what I love in this episode is you get that one point where you can tell that even for Chekhov, he knows that he's just jabbing his crewmates with right. that when they're sitting in the bar. He says, Scotch was invented by a little old woman in Leningrad.
In Leningrad, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. But he has this smile on his face, like, haha, I got you.
And I think there are little twists in this episode that you don't expect. You can miss them if you're not looking for them. Like in the sparring between Spock and McCoy, most of the time McCoy gets that last jab at Spock for being too logical and not human enough. But this time Spock kind of gets the last word in for McCoy, and that's again a funny moment because it doesn't usually happen. And so this episode kind of takes the standard relationships and turns them on their head a bit, and that's always funny. Mm-hmm.
Spock is 100% Troll Spock in this episode, and Troll Spock is my favorite thing ever. From the very beginning, which I even forgot that this scene was in this episode, but the opening scene with Spock and Chekhov is just so funny, and I still think about it extremely little, Ensign.
That's so awesome.
Just making a little joke. And that's one of the things that I love when Spock has this completely blank face, but he is so aware of the joke. It's one of those things where he will take somebody's joke. Like in this case, Chekhov is talking about how they'll be close enough to smell them. It's like, smells don't travel through the vacuum of space. And he insists on taking it literally. When you know Spock is savvy enough to not take that literally, that's 100% yeah. a troll. And then keeping his face just so perfectly blank. I love it. It's one of my favorite things about the original series is whenever Spock decides to start teasing. I enjoy it very much.
One of my favorite Spock moments in here is when Kirk is asked if he heard, and Spock says, oh, he heard you. He simply could not believe his ears.
Well, then
the one-liners are on fire in this episode.
Yeah.
There's the great Spock so awesome. Moment that happens, too, when they're all in the mess room and they're sitting there and they're with their tribbles and they're just kind of starting to realize that they're multiplying, you know. Uhura's like, oh, I had one that was pregnant, you know, and Spock picks one up and he's talking about how the cooing and everything is soothing and he's like petting it and getting more and more involved until he realizes that he's gotten a little bit too involved with this tribble and like puts it down and... You know, basically, it's like, okay, I'm back to being Spock now. Because right. it's just a great moment that every once in a while, like Spock's human half kind of comes out, and it's just really subtle, but it's also very funny, and it's a nice part of the episode because, again, you know, this is one of those episodes that I think a lot of people think of as just funny, but there's a lot going on behind the scenes with the characters and kind of what they're doing. And especially I think with the Kirk, you know, you're kind of seeing Kirk being frustrated with, like Andy, you said, the bureaucracy of, you know, Starfleet and being pushed around by bureaucrats that really don't know anything most of the time, especially in the TOS we see. And it's almost like Kirk is just, he needs a shore leave. He needs vacation. He needs to go on a holiday. Maybe he needs to get away with Bilbo the Hobbit.
I'm going on an adventure!
I don't know. But it's, you know, I just like it. There's seriousness and there's humor, and it's mixed so perfectly that, you know, you can pay attention to one or the other and get something different out of it each time you watch this episode. And that's, again, this makes it so special that there's so much going on, even when we just kind of think of this as, oh, that's the quintessential humorous episode of TOS.
I'm glad you mentioned the bureaucracy, because I think we've all experienced something like that. You know, something comes down from on high, we think it's just the most ridiculous thing we have to deal with, and our reaction is just like Kirk's, well, that's just lovely.
Exactly.
I work in local government. I can tell you that this exists. just stupid directives that, you know, are made for no reason, and you have to you carry them out and just sigh to yourself.
It has to be equally frustrating, right, for you working there, or
well, at least I've never had Tribbles take over my office and then get in my chicken sandwich. So I'll say that.
But I have to think that might be nice, right? Kind of break things up a little bit, break up the monotony.
I could certainly use the soothing noises throughout the day. I could definitely use that.
Well, and all right. What's really... you hear that, listeners? Please send Andy a bunch of doves.
What's really funny, too, is that this episode has that funny... I was talking to John Mills, and we were kind of commenting, and he said that he felt like this episode was a really great portrayal of how people feel about their animals, you know, the furry creatures. And what's mm-hmm. great is that this episode has a bunch of different people with different responses to the Tribbles, and how they feel about them, whether it's Spock or McCoy or Kirk. And, you know, Kirk's semi-annoyed at them and doesn't really like them all that much. And Spock just is like, it's a science thing, and McCoy kind of loves them, and of course then you have the rest of the crew who's kind of falling for them. But I just thought that was interesting, because that's, I mean, there's all those different types of people out there. I personally am not really a furry animal person. Part of it is I'm allergic to them, so, you know, it's frustrating to be around there for too long. But, you know, then you have other people, you know, that just, they love furry things and furry animals, and they can't have enough of them. So I love that this episode has something to say for all the, you know, animal lovers and non-animal lovers out there, because you can kind of see yourself portrayed on screen, you know, whether it's Kirk, Spock, or McCoy, or Uhura, or, you know, whoever else. So it's kind of funny.
Yeah, I'm probably closer to Uhura in this regard. I think there's kind of this irresistible, irreducible cuteness factor to the Tribbles. And it's one of these things that just draws me right into the episode. I'm a cat person. I love cats. You know, I could see myself being a crazy cat lady in another life. And I kind of picture Uhura being kind of a crazy Tribble lady when she gets old. I can relate to Uhura on this one. You know, pile on the Tribbles. There's nothing wrong with them.
I like when Uhura is sitting at the table and all the crew are around. She's got all these Tribbles, and we find out that she just got the Tribble yesterday, and now it's multiplied to this many, and people want to have some. And she says, "Oh, it's okay. I think they're old enough." Right? And they're like one day old. But it's like that motherly instinct, like, okay, you know, I think they're old enough. It reminds me how I used to have a Jack Russell Terrier, and we also had a Yorkshire Terrier, and it's actually the Yorkie I'm thinking of, where we bought the Yorkie, and the people wanted us to take the puppy home when it was like 2 weeks old, and we're like, it's too soon, like it needs to be with her mother a little bit longer. So we insisted on them keeping the dog for about 6 weeks, and then we would take it home. But here, Uhura, one day it's fine. Take them. They're ready to go.
It does look like they're pretty full grown by then.
It does. Yeah. So and that's how you judge it by size, right?
Yeah, but like the considering that then they have babies like immediately, that's right. Pretty full grown.
You know, while we're talking about Uhura, though, I had this thought about Uhura that, you know, even though this is largely just a humorous episode, you know, Star Trek is known for being progressive. And it struck me in this episode as I rewatched it that Uhura mainly wanted to go shopping and mother the Tribbles. And it wasn't the most progressive thing for Uhura to do, even in a humorous episode like this.
There's also no other women.
Whoa. You forgot the well, waitress
there's
at the bar.
There's a waitress in the bar.
And there's some other women at that table in the mess hall scene. So, I mean, I'm just saying. Yeah.
Women
and
everywhere.
For all we know, a lot of those Tribbles may have been female. So
they are bisexual. So
can we count the Tribble cooing to Uhura as a Bechdel cat pass? You know, okay, two female characters speaking about something other than a man. Coo.
I think
coo.
So. But because Uhura is a communications officer, she is very talented with languages. She probably understood.
Yeah,
She speaks Tribble.
She's the Tribble whisperer. Yeah.
Well, and just think about this. Okay, the most serious aspect, I think, of this episode is probably what they talk about, the idea of taking a species out of its natural environment, and you get, you know, this chaoticness. You know, without the natural predator against the Tribbles multiply like crazy. So, I mean, there's an interesting ecological message here about like maybe we shouldn't take just anything away from its environment and put it in a zoo or whatever, because we don't know what the repercussions are going to be. You know, that's a really mind-blowing thought, and it's in there because Spock even talks about it. In fact, Cyrano Jones is like, what did you say? And then he has to dumb it down, you know, for the rest of us who might not speak Spock. And it's a really interesting thing for them to kind of weave into this episode that you're probably really not expecting.
Yeah, especially in the 60s, right?
Right. Well, and as silly as this episode is, but I mean, it's the whole idea of like, you know, maybe we should let certain animals stay where they are is a good thought. So,
Well, I mean, there are a lot of invasive species that can just wreak havoc on an ecosystem. So it's something that we definitely need to be careful of.
Well, and it's happened here, especially in the States, you know, whether it's a species of plant or like zebra mussels taking over lakes big time here in the States. So that's definitely been something that has actually happened in real life, because we haven't been aware of the repercussions of introducing a non-native plant and or animal to another environment that it wasn't meant to be in. So yeah, it's a really interesting idea. And again, it goes along with, there's tons of funny in here, but there's a lot of serious that's going on too. And you know, who would have thought, again, from the Tribble episode, that you were talking about like ecological disasters because of, you know, not so much forethought into what you're doing with and where you're bringing something. So it's nice.
Well, let me ask you, Matthew, do you think this episode would have been so popular and remain a fan favorite if the Enterprise had been overrun with zebra mussels?
You know, that's the thing. I mean, I'm not a furry animal person, but I can't think that anybody wants to hold a zebra mussel and like caress it and hold it against their like chest, you know, and like,
I'm just picturing like every control panel on the bridge has zebra mussels clamped on it. They can't get to the controls. They can't go to warp when they need to.
I've seen pictures like the bottom of boats and stuff with them. No, that's just not a pretty picture.
The outside, the warp nacelles are clamped with zebra mussels.
Oh man,
we also get a fair amount of commentary on overpopulation and having enough food to sustain a population, not just with the Tribbles, but with the fact that they're trying to develop this planet and trying to have enough food to develop this planet. So there's a fair amount of that as well from the ecological perspective.
You can even find threads of what I would call moral philosophy inside this episode. Just a tiny little thread. I'm almost making a mountain out of a molehill, but Kirk's line that too much of anything, even love, isn't necessarily a good thing, reminds me of shades of virtue ethics, where virtue is the middle ground between these two opposing vices, just like courage would be the middle ground between cowardice and foolhardiness or recklessness. You know, we think, you know, love, pile it on, but, you know, Kirk makes this really practical point. Well, don't go too far with that. Stay in the middle.
Well, and that goes so much to who Kirk is. He's the middle ground between the two extremes of McCoy and Spock. Yeah, so it really does make sense, and that's a great point to bring up, because it's obvious that too many Tribbles, and they are becoming too many at that point, that they're not going to be a good thing. And then, of course, as Scotty's running in and they're getting into the machinery, and I mean, it's getting even worse. So, I think that's a great point, and it goes through all aspects of life. It's just like eating or drinking or anything like that. You know, you do too much of something, it's going to be bad for you. It's usually when you stay in the middle that you're going to be okay, and you have everything in moderation is what they say.
Yeah, so. At very least, it'll lead to some terrible consequences, like you get with the Tribbles, whether it's ecologically or the consequences on the ship, right? You can sort of spell that out in terms of what are the bad things that are going to happen, but you can also kind of spell it out in terms of this sort of imbalance of your inner being, right? If you start veering too much one direction, whether it's a hobby, whether it's an interest, whether it's romance, whatever it is, you're not your inner self isn't really balanced, and then of course you can say, well, look at all the bad things that'll happen.
You just mentioned something, Matthew, which created a connection I never noticed before, the fact that Sting is a Star Trek fan, which must be why the Police named their album Tribble in the Machine.
Yeah. So it's...
Maybe you'll listen to this show.
Yeah. Well, so Sting, Matthew, is a huge fan, so yeah.
Right. Matthew, you mentioned something very interesting on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Which is how Cyrano Jones is like a proto-Quark.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because I'm watching this episode, and obviously, you know, Chris, we're huge Deep Space Nine fans, and Trials and Tribulations is one of our favorites, and it does such a great job of merging with this episode. But watching Cyrano Jones and the way that he interacts, especially when he's trying to sell these to the bartender and then to Uhura, it just, everything about him was pretty much Quark in Deep Space Nine, especially those first couple of seasons where he's, mm-hmm. you know, he's always trying to make a buck. He's always trying to make some latinum, and he's always trying to find the angle for him that's going to be best, and sometimes getting caught and sometimes not. And I thought it was really interesting because, you know, when you think about it, this episode is basically, it almost kind of is an episode of Deep Space Nine because it takes place on that space station that's very reminiscent of what we see later on in Deep Space Nine. You had the commander's office, you know, that they would go to and talk. You know, you have the bar area where there's the bartender and the guy trying to finagle you into something. And it makes me wonder if this possibly had anything to do with when they thought of, well, maybe we could put it on a space station and it might be pretty interesting for Deep Space Nine. Regardless, it is very fun to see that they had to have thought a little bit of Cyrano Jones when they started reformatting the Ferengi from leather whip carriers to, you know, what they become as the very much quintessential over-capitalistic, misogynistic race that mm-hmm. was reminiscent of where, yeah. You know, the writers, I think, saw, say, the United States and the Western world in the early, you know, yeah. 90s.
Well, I can see the path there, actually. You've got Ferengi, the leather whips, yes, but also the fur.
Mm-hmm.
Tribbles
mm-hmm.
have fur.
Mm-hmm.
Cyrano Jones.
It all fits. It's all connected.
Takes to Quark. Yeah.
Hashtag it's all connected.
Follow it. It's all connected.
Well, I have to think that Quark would approve of Cyrano Jones's negotiation skills. He's pretty good at it. He gets the best deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't help but wish that Quark had come along in Trials and Tribulations.
Yeah. And there's no way they could have had a scene together that would have really worked. But can you imagine those two characters going at each other trying to negotiate a price for the tribbles? Like,
well, maybe you could have Quark behind the scenes and then Jones could be in there making the deals, but then he comes back and then they have to split up the credits,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Quark would be like,
seven
credits for me, one credit for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Seven credits for me.
Hey, that's
one
not fair.
Yeah, that's not Quark's way.
Okay, how about this? 8 credits. No, I think I've jumped one over what actually happened with Rom, but yeah.
Oh, good stuff.
I got a Deep Space Nine reference. Woo!
There
right.
you go,
you're,
Andy.
You're getting there, Andy. You're getting there.
Achievement unlocked.
Ding.
Well, let's talk about continuity a little bit, because for the most part with TOS, you can watch the episodes in any order and they make perfect sense. If you're really into TOS, you can tell, you know, third season episodes because you can see what's going on with the production.
Everybody can tell a third season episode.
What's that?
Everybody can tell when it's the third season.
but you know, you can watch them in any order, it's fine. There's very little continuity. They don't reference themselves very much. But here they actually do reference themselves. They reference Errand of Mercy, the Organian Peace Treaty, and they actually build the episode around it. So we can talk about a couple of things here. Of course, the continuity and the reference. Maybe would we have liked to have seen more of that? And then also, I'd like to talk about the Klingons a little bit, because it's very interesting watching these Klingons after you've grown so accustomed to how Klingons are portrayed everywhere else in the franchise.
You know, you mentioned the Organian Treaty, and of course, that's reaching back to a previous episode from season one, Errand of Mercy. And it struck me, that Star Trek is taking place in the middle of the Cold War, and with the Organian Treaty, in that episode, Errand of Mercy, you get kind of the Federation, the Klingon, literally being on the brink of war, right? And the Organians have to pacify the situation because of their higher enlightenment.
Well, and the Klingons even say there's been no formal declaration of hostilities between us.
Sure. But after the treaty, you get kind of this Cold War situation in the episode in Trouble with Tribbles, where you don't have the brink of war anymore, even though the Enterprise is ready to go, you know, blaze to the space station because they think that the Klingons are attacking, which they're not. It's fascinating to me that Kirk even jumps to the assumption that the Klingons are attacking, and really they just want to, you know, antagonize the space station. But you get
Zachary. He doesn't trust them, and he never will.
He never will. Exactly. Never has.
Luckily, they hadn't killed his boy yet, so...
But, you know, after the Organian Treaty, you get kind of this antagonistic hostility, but no war, right? And they can build the humor of the episode around that antagonism.
Well, and it's interesting because that faux niceness that kind of happens between them too, you know, is very reminiscent of what you would see between leaders of Russia and the United States at that point, where they would play nice in front of the cameras, you know, or in front of other people. And then, you know, I'm sure they were talking smack between each other's backs, or if they were just, you know, this had just been the Enterprise meeting a Klingon ship, core ship, you know, in space, they wouldn't have had such nice things to say to each other, you know? And so it is really funny to watch that really play out. And it is interesting to watch Star Trek portray the Cold War in such a kind of perfect fashion. You know, I mean, they're really portraying exactly what it was like when you had leaders of both sides together in a place where they had to play nice.
Well, it echoes that famous UN meeting where they walked up and said, "My dear Premier Khrushchev."
Well, you know, Chekhov claiming everything as a Russian invention, you know, is similar to what you get in Star Trek VI when you get Chang saying that that you have to read Shakespeare in the original Klingon.
Right,
it's just
right.
Something that regimes of that sort tend to take credit for everything. And you even see shades of that in the most recent Olympics, that rollout of the history of Russian inventions before the opening of the Olympics. There was some. You know, dramatic video presentation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I didn't see that here.
Yeah, okay. You should find it. It's brilliant. But
it was narrated
that's the kind of
by Chekhov.
Yeah,
narrated by Chekhov. And then at the end, they actually bring this little old lady from Leningrad out.
Right.
Ask her.
Yeah.
How'd you come up with all these ideas?
You should thank me for the scotch.
Well, they do use the Klingons to pretty great effect to explore this in a lot of episodes. The other one that comes to mind right away is A Private Little War, where they really explore kind of Vietnam and the kind of Cold War tactics of proxy wars in that one. So, and it makes perfect sense that this is something that is on the writers' minds. I mean, they were living through it, you know, that it comes out in their writing, and it's something that they were clearly very interested in exploring, and I think it translates well. It's maybe not A Private Little War so much, but in this one, it definitely works and adds an extra depth to the episode.
It is such an interesting thing, too, because these Klingons and the Klingons of the original series, I think when I go back and watch it now, it's somewhat retconned in my brain so that I see them differently. Mm-hmm. And I kind of see them more in the vein of what I know them to be the rest of the series. And yet, at the same time, these Klingons are just so different than what we do get in the rest of all the series of Star Trek. And, you know, there are much more, as we've always said, I think, on the network, the Romulans and the Klingons switch places later on.
Yeah,
you know,
they switch places.
And
in the modern Trek.
These are just kind of those devious, backstabbing, you know, troublemaking Klingons. Whereas that's how we think of the Romulans later on. And so it's very strange because there is a kind of a disconnect between the continuity of Star Trek from TOS to the rest of the series with the way that we play the Klingons. And of course, I mean, as Worf said, we don't talk about it with outsiders. But it is also jarring when you're watching TOS later after seeing everything else that these Klingons just really look like humans, even though when they're talking about how they dislike the Earthers, you know, and how much that their ships are garbage scowls, you know, and whatnot. It's just it's really strange just going back.
Well, you know, of course, the Klingons turn more into these sort of Viking, samurai kind of mixed culture in modern Star Trek, whereas here, they very much are there to represent the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also there to represent like another side of us as humans. Whereas later in Star Trek, they become a lot more of, yeah, they're this alien race that we don't get along with, as less so than being part of who we are. You know, being part of who we are, it's replaced, as we said, by the Romulans, the deviousness. You know, the Romulans in modern Star Trek represent the Soviet regime or the Chinese communist regime that the Klingons did in the original series. But then we also get races like the Ferengi, which everybody hates, but the Ferengi in DS9 Forward represent a very specific part of who we are as humans. And when we look at the Klingons here, though, we really see that. And it's interesting to me when I watch this, of trying to watch it on the original level, which is how I watched it for many, many years before TNG came along and those Klingons came along. And then at the same time, trying to watch it thinking, okay, these are the Klingons that we've been seeing, how they interacted with Archer in the 22nd century. And then we know their history with Kirk and then with Picard. And, you know, not so much with Janeway because they have very few Klingon moments on that show. But even picturing them, like trying to picture them visually looking like the Klingons that we know later, it's an interesting experience.
What I love, though, is that Enterprise actually helps here for me. Because they went and did the thing that so many fanboys decried, which was to give us the explanation for what happened. I actually like that because then it
does...
What
happened with the forehead ridges,
yeah,
is all you're talking about.
But it also, it changes fundamentally who those Klingons are, because they are part human, actually, at that point. So that's why they are so much more like us. There is a place where it's like, there's them, and then there's the rest of the Klingons that still have the ridges, and, you know. So I kind of...
Yeah.
It just helps me to, when I have all the story there, to kind of place, okay, well, these Klingons are, I don't remember the Klingon word that they call themselves, but, you know.
But we're getting really deep now, yeah. Matthew, because not only do we need Enterprise for that, but we actually need comics for that, too, to flesh that out, what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the comic series that we did, is it Blood Will Tell? Is that the name of it?
Oh, goodness.
I forget the exact name, but it's a Blood, but it's, that one is really important for filling that in as well. The fact that, yes, you have these two different offshoots of Klingons, mm-hmm. basically.
Yep.
But then DS9 muddies the waters again a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it is interesting. And obviously, in the end, it's just fiction. And you just have to let it go and you have a good time. So it is funny, though, when we start to get into the real minutiae of Star Trek and trying to fit it all together. And on a whole, I think most of the time, Star Trek fans are pretty good at just letting those kind of things go. And it's just a TV show. And that's where that stuff's not important. The other stuff that we have been talking about what this episode was teaching us and all of that, and that's what Star Trek was really always kind of meant to be about.
Matthew, if Star Trek fans are good at letting that stuff go, I think it depends on which Facebook groups you're reading.
That is probably
true. You're reading.
I probably spend too much time in our egalitarian group known as the Babel Conference, where we all share opinions very friendly and nobody's yelling at each other. And so,
well, you know, we've been given kind of a largely a political reading of this relationship between the humans and the Klingons in the original series, but I think one of the fascinating things you can do with Star Trek, it's what makes it so rich, is you can give different kinds of readings. You know, you can give a psychological reading of the relationship between them as well, where the different races, their sort of essential attributes or qualities we like or dislike and we relate to or don't relate to are different facets of human psychology. You know, and this is, I think, the beauty of invoking the Organians in the peace treaty, right? From this higher perspective of the Organians, the humans and the Klingons aren't all that different, right? You know,
right.
We're just as aggressive as they are from their perspective. And you can kind of say, you know, we have this sort of inherent similarity with them, and yet each race represents something different about ourselves that we like or don't like. And we can put that in space and make an alien race out of it, give them funny forehead ridges sometimes, and, you know, either romanticize them like you get in the later versions of Star Trek, or here you can say there's things we don't like about human nature, and that's why it's interesting to have to encounter that out in outer space.
Well, I think that's why Errand of Mercy works so well, is because in the end you see that Kirk has a fair amount in common with the way that Klingons are reacting. Like, when the Organians lay down this peace treaty, they react the same, which is disbelief and anger. And it's kind of cool to see that Kirk thinks he's way above it, but he's not quite. He hasn't quite made it above that. And I think that's why that episode works so well.
You know, it reminds me, too, when we're talking about the Klingons here, not to get off on a divergence on Axanar here, but just because of what you said, some of the premise of Axanar is that the Klingons perceived the Federation coming together as an aggressive expansion, which triggered their reaction to it. So I think, like you're saying here, it works both ways. And like from the Organians, they see it being very similar between the Federation and the Earthers and the Klingons. And it is how you perceive it, depending on which side you're on.
And I love that Axanar is going that direction, because this is something Star Trek has done many times, right? We talked about a couple of them already. The Ferengi become, they were originally, I forget how you characterized it, Matthew, but they were withholding aliens. But, you know, they become something relatable at the end of Deep Space Nine. In Next Generation, you get relatable Klingons. And that's part of, you know, finding this better approach to relating to your enemy is humanizing them and seeing things from their point of view. And that's something Star Trek has done, something Axanar is doing, and something, you know, the TOS doesn't do very well, right? They tend to polarize, and the later versions of Star Trek tend to, try to make things more relatable.
Well, the original series was working at a disadvantage because there was no way to rewatch them at that point. So there's no way to, if you missed an episode, it's really hard to deal with things with nuance there, which is why they use so many allegories and why they use so many characters that are very broad, so people can relate to them right away, watch the episode, and then, you know, move on. Whereas, you know, even by the time we get to TNG, there's more of a way to do arced episodes, and then, like, farther on, it's even easier. But this whole idea of Star Trek examining the enemies, so they set up so many different enemies, and then I think especially I start to see this in TNG, they do a really good job of having episodes that make you kind of change the way you've seen them. The one that comes to mind as like the most meaningful way for me is the I, Borg one from TNG, mm-hmm. where I would never have thought from the way they introduced the Borg that you could ever have an episode in which you could start to relate to the Borg. I would never have predicted that working. And I mean, I'm sure that there are people who don't like the direction that took for the Borg as a villain, but I thought it was an amazing episode because I really love that idea. I think it's something that we as humans need to work on better, is not demonizing our opponents in anything, really. War or even just political differences, this sort of thing. So that's one of my favorite things that Star Trek does, and you see it over and over again. And I mean, I've just started DS9, but that's one of my favorite things about DS9 too, is, you know, seeing the Cardassians in all of these different lights and all of the different races being fleshed out in really interesting ways. And my degree is in international relations, so all this stuff is super, super interesting to me. And I really love all of these different social allegories that they have for these different races and the way that they write them.
I think I, Borg works because you're dealing with one individual there. Later in Star Trek, not to spoil things for you, but you probably know like the general story, that we get more into where we're like, able to talk to the entire collective and negotiate with them, which that's where fans kind of feel it probably doesn't work. But with I, Borg, I think it's a very great episode because Picard has to actually confront one individual that he can talk to.
Yeah, I really like that episode. That was one of my favorites in TNG. And I can see why, you know, it's too bad to lose this monolithic enemy so much. But I still really like that idea, and seeing it be explored in a meaningful way is cool.
Well, that's one of the things that, you know, it's a huge difference between especially TOS and TNG, is that TNG is postmodern ideology and thought, and, you know, TOS is very much modern in the sense of there's right, there's wrong, and we're the right ones. Like, that's Kirk all the time. Like, he's that guy in the original series. And whereas, you know, Picard is much more on the side of like, well, that's your thing. We have our thing. You have your thing. And, well, we can't tell you whether you're right or not, you know? So, yeah, that's a huge difference between, and a big shift between those series. And they're pretty far apart at that point too, so it's not surprising that there's a huge cultural shift in the way that we look at the world at that point. So
it makes the shift towards relativism and pluralism in later series really accounts for some of the dramatic tension you get in the later series, right? You know, you want to simultaneously recognize the different races or different species have their own way of life, their own values, their own systems, but the Federation has its own ideals and actively pursues those at the same time as trying to recognize the validity of other races' approaches. Yeah, and TOS just hadn't got that far yet. It was a very much a modern world at that point in the 60s, but a progressive, modern, you know, linear trajectory kind of world, and wasn't pluralistic per se.
Well, let's talk about one more thing here, because we're getting close to an hour, and I want to touch on one more topic, and then this episode's place in history. And the other topic is something that comes up in the James Blish novelization of this episode, where Spock makes the remark that there is an elegant symmetry of the respective misdeeds, saying that the poisoning of the grain eliminated the Tribble infestation before it exhausted the cargo, whereas the Tribbles disclosed the poisoning with no loss of human life. And Zachary, I know you had some specific thoughts on this.
Yeah, you know, I haven't read the novelization, but it occurred to me in the way you characterized it that these two opposing misdeeds kind of work together to create some dramatic tension without any real serious consequences or violence, right? And this is something that makes Star Trek relatively unique in the sphere of science fiction universes, I think. Star Trek is more than willing to introduce dramatic tension in a science fiction dramatic tension, right? But without having to go the direction of violence or war or gore, or having people, you know, doing pew-pew-pew with lasers at each other, right? They have a perfectly wonderful dramatic episode with some humor in it, and these two opposing forces kind of cancel each other out. And we talked about the Cold War analogy, and this is kind of a Cold War analogy, right? You get these two opposing forces that kind of cancel each other out, and you get some overall stability, and there's no real negative consequence in this show, and that's what makes it so lighthearted and fun.
It is disappointing, though, and I will point out that PETA was very disappointed with this episode because all right. Tribbles were harmed during the making of this episode. On a serious note, it is interesting, though, because there is that strange felicitous event of, you know, this, they wouldn't have found out about the grain without the Tribbles, and the Klingon infiltrator without the Tribbles. And a lot of people probably would have died without this, you know, random character like Cyrano Jones, this kind of lovable rogue that he is in this episode. And the part that that kind of character plays in a story, you know, almost, you could really kind of almost characterize him as the court jester of this story. And that those kind of characters have their roles I'm going to invoke it, but the same way that, say, Jar Jar Binks does in the prequels, it, you know, Cyrano Jones is, I guess, the Jar Jar Binks of this episode.
Ouch.
And ouch. But they play the same kind of role, though, of having a important twist to their character without them even knowing it, you know, without them really doing anything other than kind of just being themselves. They bring out an important event in their respective show and in series. So it's a great one of those literary type of turns where the everything comes together and you're like, oh, you know. And I think David Gerrold just writes really well with Star Trek because he's using some nice literary motifs to create this story that you're not paying attention to because you're too busy laughing at everything that's going on. But if you're really breaking this episode down, it's really well done.
Speaking of David, if you go back and listen to Axanar podcast number 25, we had David on, and also Axanar podcast number 2 as well. And at some point in the discussion, we talked for a long time, but at some point he actually does talk a bit about this episode and what he was doing, I think particularly with the Klingons here. But if you want to hear from David about what he was thinking, go check that out. about the Tribbles here, one difference I see between this being written in the 1960s and if it were written today or even on TNG, I don't think that the death of all of the Tribbles would be dismissed so easily. You know, the idea that this was discovered without any loss of human life, you know, that's great. But I also think that in modern Star Trek, there would be more of a concern that this other life form, so many of them were killed in the process.
Well, that was one of the first things that was jarring for me when I went from, because I went from TNG back to TOS. And there's that episode, what is it, The Man Trap? With the
Salt Empire.
Yeah, the Salt Woman. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to put that better.
Salt Vampire.
She's a Salt Vampire.
And I was sitting there and they were going through the episode and I'm like thinking to myself, Picard would have found a way to save this person. Well, this being, the Salt Vampire.
I mean, Beverly would just whip up some salt tablets.
Well, that's what I was saying. I was sitting there, I'm like, just give her some salt. Like, I don't understand.
Right. You got to have plenty of salt on the ship. Go to the replicator and say, give me a bucket of salt.
Yeah, that's, give her salt, that's where I was at. But, I mean, it really is. It's very different the way that they, TNG tackles, you know, life and unique life versus the original series. Kirk is much more pragmatic, I guess you could put it, and Picard is more idealistic, and Picard really goes out of his way several times to make sure that life is protected in all its forms. And I mean, even stuff that we wouldn't consider life right away, I'm thinking of the nanites that Wesley makes. I mean, I remember at the end of that, like, thinking, wow, not very many people would have considered that to be a tragedy.
Yeah,
it's one thing I really love about him.
Kirk is reckless about alien life, but he's more willing to do what's necessary to protect his crew if it comes to that. I mean, there are situations where he does recognize unique life, like within The Devil in the Dark with the Horta. There are situations. So I don't think he's reckless about it, but there's definitely a stark difference between how he approaches it and how Picard approaches it.
I feel like we're being a little unfair, though. I mean, there are at least two instances that I can think of in the episode where there's concern for the Tribbles. One is when McCoy wants to study the Tribbles and Uhura says, you know, don't harm a hair on its head and, or its body, wherever that is, McCoy says. So, you know, they don't want to dissect the Tribbles, so they've got at least concern for life there. And of course,
well,
it's done
in
the...
Uhura doesn't want to know about it if Owens is going to do it.
That's true. It's done in the context of a joke, though. I mean, the final scene when Scotty beams the Tribbles over to the Klingon ship, mm-hmm. Kirk says, you know, Scotty, you didn't beam them into space. And Scotty says, no, I wouldn't do that. That would be inhuman. So there's at least some concern, but we already said that Kirk is a pragmatist, right? He's willing to make whatever practical trade-offs are necessary to protect his ship and his crew and reach the outcome he wants. And if you have to sacrifice a few Tribbles, they almost get to the point where they're laughing at the death of the Tribbles in the storage compartments. McCoy says, you know, a lot of them are dead. A lot of them are alive. You know, they almost turn it into a little joke. So they're a bit more flippant about it, I'd say. But you know, they're not totally dismissive of the value of the Tribbles. They're, you
and
know,
someone
overall in the context
close
of the show.
That door.
The worst storage compartment design ever. By the way, I don't understand.
That. It's better if you know if you think about Deep Space Nine and it's Dax and.
I know.
Cisco chucking them at his head. That's really funny.
I know. I cannot get that out of my head. I found it really hard to separate these two episodes.
Jadzia is having a blast up there throwing Tribbles at Kirk.
I like what you said, though, Zachary. I think that they do have a good respect for the Tribbles here. And they're not mourning the Tribbles that died because it wasn't their fault. You know, they weren't the ones that placed them there near the grain. You know, that there wasn't anything they could do. So it's like you're not going to cry over spilled milk.
It's hindsight, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. They didn't kill the Tribbles. Tribbles.
Exactly. I mean, although Scotty does beam them over to the Klingon ship, and those Tribbles aren't going to live. They're going to be incinerated by, you know, disruptors. So I don't know if beaming them to space might not have been nicer at that point, seriously.
But then how would we have had the great pun, Matthew? Think of the big picture.
Well, exactly. That's no true. And then you couldn't have everybody laughing at the end, which, you know, which actually is one of the few times on... you know, the original series where they are laughing at the end and you feel like it's vindicated. Like
it's appropriate.
Yeah,
I know we're getting back to talking about the humor here, but one of the things that, you know, we're talking about the scene with the storage compartments. You know, one of the things that's funny is just the sheer imagery of these tribbles, right? This mountain of tribbles piled on top of Captain Kirk, tribbles stuck against the wall on the Enterprise. As I was watching this, I couldn't help but think, come on, Captain Kirk, couldn't you have been planning ahead a little more than that, and at least on a barrel roll out of the way of this pile of tribbles?
I don't know if a barrel roll would have saved him here. There are just too many tribbles falling at once.
Yep, no time for the barrel.
It's a lot of tribbles.
But I will say, who designs storage compartments that open down from the ceiling, right? It doesn't matter what's in there, it's going to fall on your head.
I guess you have to empty them into something, so maybe there's a container or something that would go below.
I guess it's terrible design.
Not their finest set work.
All right, well, let's wrap up with our thoughts on this episode's place in history within Star Trek. You know, I love the fact that we didn't mention it's the precursor to Gremlins, as well as the precursor to many great humorous Star Trek episodes. What are your thoughts on that, Andy?
Well, I mean, when I first watched it, I didn't really know its place in history, which is kind of fun for
me. Yeah, you were in a unique position.
I think people are always surprised at how I actually didn't know anything. I think people that have been in the Star Trek fandom for a long time are always surprised at very basic things that they thought that I must have known somehow. And Tribbles were one of them where I was like, sorry, guys, I have no idea. But now that I'm a bit more into it, I just think it's like Matthew was talking about how it's quintessential Star Trek. I really have to agree there. Like, there's so many character moments that are just so perfect and so indicative of those characters and, you know, their personalities. And so whenever I'm trying to think of like some of the best Scotty moments or the best Spock moments or the best Kirk and McCoy moments, I'm thinking of this episode. And that to me says a lot about how long I'm going to care about this episode. And I haven't gotten a chance to watch the DS9 one, although I have seen the animated series one. Not quite as good.
So you saw the giant King Tribble.
Yes.
In More Tribbles, More Troubles.
I must say that I enjoyed the animated series much more than I thought I would, because I just like the colors, and I think it's real fun and silly. And I think if you're not trying to take it too seriously, that's a really cool show.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing more of them, and I certainly see why they've endured. I mean, you just have the general cuteness, but then also this episode is just so perfectly crafted. Of course it's going to hold up.
What about you, Matthew?
I always go back to the fact that when they decided to do the celebration for the 35th anniversary for Deep Space Nine for Star Trek, that they chose this episode. You know, they had thought about doing a piece of the action, which would have been really funny and could have been very well done. I would have loved to have seen that. But they chose this episode instead, and I think it's because it is Star Trek, the original series, at its finest. And there's no episode that is really, I think, more iconic than probably City on the Edge of Forever. And so when you think of its place in history, well, it's at the top there with the original series. You know, it's either one, two, or three for most people when they talk about their favorite episodes of the original series. So because of that, and because of the character work here, and then, geez, for all the things that we were able to pull out of this very humorous episode, I think that it will continue to go down in history as one of TOS's best episodes. And it's always a delight to say, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to watch, you know, The Trouble with Tribbles, and I always come away, you know, better than when I left, you know, when I started. It's just that kind of the episode. So I think its place in history will always be where it is, which is it's one of the best episodes of TOS that they ever did.
How about you, Zachary?
Yeah, it as I was thinking about this, it struck me that there are sort of three main influences in the trouble with Tribbles and its relationship to Star Trek history. One is the thing we've already mentioned, just that this is the episode that even non-Star Trek fans know and will recognize and laugh about, right? It's managed to cross this cultural divide where people know who Captain Kirk is, people know who Spock is, and people know who Tribbles are, right? And so that speaks volumes. It's like Matthew was saying, it's at the very top. You can sort of think of this pyramid of Star Trek episodes. There's the sort of the filler episodes at the bottom. Most of them fall somewhere in the middle. Then there's the one, two, or three at the very top. And this is in my one, two, or three. You can also pare it down to the influences that this episode has had on other series. And I came up with a short list. Of course, we've got the Deep Space Nine episode, Trials and Tribulations. We've got the Enterprise influence on dealing with a Klingon forehead issue. We've got the animated series, the Tribble sequel, and the one that really jumps out to me is Star Trek IV, the idea that you can have a perfectly fun, dramatic movie without any violence, and that's something that, that Star Trek IV really latched onto. They did it very intentionally, and you can trace that right back to the trouble with Tribbles. And finally, I listened to the Ready Room episode, I think it was 93, on the Deep Space Nine episode, Trials and Tribulations, that remastering of this episode for that show spawned this effort to remaster all of Star Trek, right? Get all the original series in high definition, which led to getting Star Trek The Next Generation in high definition. Fingers crossed, maybe someday we'll get Deep Space Nine and Voyager in high definition. But the effort to remaster this episode started that trend in some way. So there is this influence on our fandom as a result of that.
Well, we didn't do our ratings. So Andy, what are you going to give this episode?
I'm going to give it 10 out of 10 Kirk chicken sandwiches.
Awesome. How about you, Matthew?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to give this 10 out of 10 Klingon infiltrators.
Wow. All right. They disguised a lot of them. How about you, Zachary?
You know, this is such a good episode, I'm going to give it a slightly higher rating than usual. I'm going to give it 1,771,561 Tribbles played by Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
Awesome. And I didn't recognize him in a single one of them.
Does he play one of them or all of them? That's the $64,000 question.
All right. Well, I'm going to give this a better rating than 10 as well. I'm going to give this 12 Klingons, which, as you know, constitutes a swarm.
It does.
Very nice.
It does. I kept seeing Dax and Sisko in that scene, even though they weren't there.
Right. Well, and in the lineup, I was picturing Bashir there. Yes, I was picturing Miles there. So, yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, Zachary. Before we go, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs.
Absolutely. You can find me on Facebook and Trek FM's listeners group, the Babel Conference. And you can also find me on Twitter. It's just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZacharyFruhling.
Awesome. All right. And Andy, tell everyone where they can find you.
Oh, well, you can check me out on Women at Warp, also on Trek FM, or you can follow along with my live tweeting of Star Trek. I'm on DS9, and that is at First Time Trek.
And if people want to send you a box of Doves to keep you calm at the office, where should they send those?
I wish I could give you the exact address, because I would definitely enjoy that. I'm pretty sure my boss wouldn't like it, though.
Yeah, I don't think the local government there would appreciate that. So, all right. Okay, well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Chris, I've got to say, you know, one, it is fantastic to be back in the Ready Room. I'm disappointed, though, that the Ready Room doesn't have such fine drinks as Ruby does in the 602 Club. Maybe we
it's all Earl Grey cocktails and stuff, but, you know.
The fish tank, though, is really nice. We need to get one of those.
Okay, well, thanks.
For the 602.
I try.
But talking about, I think, what could be argued as the most popular episode of TOS was just a blast.
It was, and I think we went in some interesting directions beyond just the basic, you know, it's a fun furry humorous episode, getting furry with it.
Getting furry with it. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Getting furry with it. Yeah, that was Will Smith's. That was going to be his hit, but then he realized that Jiggy with it sounded better than furry.
Yeah, and also it cannot be misconstrued in different ways. So, But anyway, I like talking about serious aspects of this episode as well, and I think we did a good job with that. It was interesting to me anyway. So if you're listening and you have feedback on this episode, we would love to hear from you. There are many ways for you to get in touch with us. Of course, you can send us an email, go old-fashioned email, by going to trek.fm/contact and using the form there, or choosing the Ready Room and sending us your message, and that'll come to us by email. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Our main Facebook page is TrekFM, facebook.com/TrekFM. But we also have this great group on Facebook called the Babel Conference, and that's where our listeners really get together. We've got, I guess we're getting close to 800 listeners just in that group right now who are involved in discussing the shows and the topics and other things about Star Trek the way we do here on the network. So, Matthew, tell everyone about the Babel Conference.
Well, yeah, Chris. I mean, the Babel Conference is really the place to be if you're a listener of Trek FM and you enjoy our shows. You know, we have amazing conversations going on with the shows. And I think one of the best things about the Babel Conference is just the respect and care that we have for one another. And, you know, the conversations there are respectful. And that doesn't happen very often on the internet.
Especially not on Facebook.
Yeah, and a Facebook. Yeah. So I really like the Babel Conference. I encourage you to go over there and join the group. We'd love to let you in and be a part of the conversation with us because it is a fun, I think, and on a whole, mostly family atmosphere for Trek and all the things as well that we talk about on the 602 Club. So come on over to the Babel Conference. You won't be sad you joined.
Yeah, good point. Because of the 602 Club, we do allow discussion of pretty much any geek topic. So we talk about Star Wars in there sometimes. We talk about, you know, comics and all sorts of stuff there. So it's not exclusively Star Trek, although it's primarily Star Trek. And most people, when they post things that aren't Star Trek, they start with, I know it's not Star Trek, but... and then they post. So people are aware that it is a Star Trek forum. So it's great. The way you get there is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. Or on our website, you can click discussion, and that'll take you there as well. It is a closed group, so you need to click join, but we'll let you right on in, and we hope that you will join us over there. So, Matthew, when you're not trying to talk Ruby into giving the K7 bartender a job in the 602 Club, where can people find you?
That poor guy. He has had such a tough time after Cyrano really Jones has. And the whole Tribble debacle.
He's not very friendly, though, so Ruby's going to have to, you know...
When you're dealing with Klingons and Cyrano Jones all on the same day, I can understand why you're not so friendly. Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram at MRushing. I'm on The Orb with you, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. You'll hear us talking about all the great things about Deep Space Nine, plus some fun things about the Trials and Tribulations. So if you want to hear more about that and our thoughts there, especially... bookending this episode, great place to visit. You can also find me on Literary Treks with Dan Gunther, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We also interview the authors. In fact, have a great interview out there with David Mack about his latest Seekers book. I encourage you to go listen to. So much fun. I'm also on the 602 Club, as we have mentioned, where we talk about a great new geeky topic each week. We really try to introduce people to maybe some things they haven't tried. Fantastic new episode. Just talked with John Champion, Norman Lau, and Alice Baker about The Man from U.N.C.L.E. That was a blast. Even if you haven't seen the movie, maybe you just need some encouragement to go see the movie. Check out that episode. We had a great time. And I have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not busy petting away with your Tribble and trying to keep it, you know, from breeding too much around the house, you know, where can we find you?
Just picturing how that works. Like, you can breed, just not too much.
Apparently, right? If you don't feed it too much, it doesn't breed as much. That's at least what Bone said. So I guess maybe it'd be figuring out the balance between feeding and not feeding.
I guess so. Yeah, I'll be working on that. So, before I tell you where you can find me, quick plug for a few shows here. You mentioned John Champion. Of course, anyone listening to this show knows that John's on Mission Log. Alice Baker is on a show called Educating Geeks. So if you like geeky topics and you like the 602 Club, go check out educating geeks as well. They have really fun discussions over there. They do drinking games as well for a lot of things. They have a Zelda drinking game, all kinds of stuff. It's really fun. So go check them out if you're not familiar with Educating Geeks. And of course, Norman hosting Warp 5 together with Will Wynn here on the network.
Tell you what, that 602 Club, just bring in podcasts together.
Bringing in everybody. Yeah. Coming from everywhere. But, you know, they all know Ruby's going to treat them right.
Well, apparently the 602 Club is like the Jeffrey Combs of podcasts, because it just brings everyone in. They're everywhere. It
brings everyone in. That's right. One more plug for the Ready Room. We've talked a bit during the feature and then just now about trials and tribulations. And I think Zachary actually mentioned this episode, I believe, at the end of the feature there. Larry and Shar and I talked about trials and tribulations. And actually, Matthew, you were on this show as well back a long time ago. It's the Ready Room episode 93 called 3-inch Heels and a 6-inch Hairdo. And that's a really interesting one if you want to hear more about tribbles and you want to hear about the making of trials and tribulations. So go check that out, the Ready Room 93. Okay, now if you want to find me, Matthew mentioned we do The Orb together, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine. You can also find me sometimes doing Hyperchannel here on the network, and I also produce the official Axanar podcast. You can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. I write a column there called Trekspectives. My most recent one is about taking Enterprise's 3-episode arc format and applying that to The Next Generation, and then I'll have another one out maybe in about a week or so after this show drops. So you can find me there. You can also find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook, and I'm there in the Babel Conference. So I'd love to chat with you over there. And in the world of non-Star Trek stuff, I actually do a podcast that's not about Star Trek. So if you like listening to me, I know, can you believe it? So if you like listening to me on podcasts and you want to know about many other topics, about life in Tokyo, about Japan, and other arts and entertainment and different things, I do a show called Metropolis On Air, and you can find that in iTunes, and you can also find it on our website, metropolisjapan.com. And you can get an RSS link there as well. So check that out if you're inclined. Last thing here, I just want to remind everyone that we do need your support to keep the shows coming. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And find out how you can support the network. All right, Matthew, I've got to go. I'm going to roam down and find Cyrano Jones because we need to catch up, you know, share some family stories since we're both Joneses after all.
Man, it's so hard keeping up with the Joneses. Ah, jeez.
Especially in space, because those ships, they travel fast.
That's what I hear. Faster than light, apparently. Which,
that's right.
Well, that sounds like a fun idea. I hope you have enough to drink for that, because he can talk your ear off. And it's time to stick a Tribble coffee in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Recording.
Tribble pants.
Recording. Cyrano Jones's baggy pants.
I like how all men on TOS seem to have these like cropped pants at the knees with the high boots. Like
I'm partial to the Klingon metallic pants.
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from, but it's. Well, it's
I like
odd.
That. You know, Cyrano, he can hide entire glasses of wine in his pants.
Well, that's. Yeah.
Without spilling it.
Yeah.
That's impressive right there.
23rd century cargo pants.
Yeah.
That sounds like something that should be on Enterprise. The cargo pants.
Actually, they kind of have cargo pants because they don't, I feel like if I remember correctly, there is a cargo pocket on their pants leg somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because they've got so many zippers galore. I mean,
yeah.
That uniform is zipperific.
I wonder if Starfleet made any buttonfly uniforms in the 22nd century.
They did. Remember, they have the button Henley that they have to button up on Enterprise.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean like button fly.
This is the period between Enterprise and TOS.
I think they had those in like, you know, they kept like ripping the buttons, you know, trying to get out of the uniform real quickly to get into decon. And they're like, maybe if we just put zippers on it.
Okay, well, here we go. I'm going to lead us into the show here.